turn back, if you would, to Luke chapter 22, the verse we read from 47 on to 65. That's the section we're going to look at this evening. Boys, we've got a worksheet. After us, we're sort of looking at it in two themes. There's a main theme, obviously, in these verses as we head towards the cross. But at the same time, there's something in contrast to that. Jesus, in verse 53, speaks to the chief priests and tells them, "This is your hour and the power of darkness." And that's the big theme as you look through these passages. You see the hour of darkness. But at the same time, there is a glimmer of light. That's our title. The hour of darkness, but a glimmer of light. And we see those two things in contrast. I'm going to look at those in three different bits and look at one theme and then a contrast to that as well. So we've been making our way through Luke's gospel. And over the last couple of weeks, we've thought of Jesus' time with his disciples that's come to an end. We've had the Last Supper. We had Jesus' last conversation with his disciples. Then the last prayer time in the garden. And now we're into the last bits, the last 24 hours or so, Jesus' life. And we often call this time the humiliation of Jesus. That's the first thing we're going to think about. Jesus' humiliation. And it's begun, isn't it, by Judas in verse 47. The other disciples, 11, have been there with Jesus in the garden. Jesus has been praying. They fell into sleep, but... And now, as that's drawing to an end, Judas arrives, we're told, leading. "Behold a multitude," Luke tells us quite dramatically. "And he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them." So this multitude, armed with swords and clubs, Jesus mentions in verse 52, arrive in the garden. And Judas is leading the way. He's leading this arrest party. And then he draws near to Jesus to kiss him. That was the arranged signal. But it speaks volumes, doesn't it? It could have been done in any sort of way. He could have just pointed. Said to the mob, "That's the one. Arrest him." But instead, Judas chooses this way, to identify Jesus with a kiss. In the dark garden, they needed some way to make sure that they knew who they were arresting and so on. And so this was arranged, it seems, beforehand. But Judas walked up to Jesus to kiss him. In their culture, that was a friendly thing to do. We're British, we don't tend to do that. But think of the French or the Italians. Well, they'll meet someone, even a business partner, a friend, definitely. And they'd kiss them on the cheeks. So that's what they did in their culture too. And Judas does it. Walks straight up to Jesus. They kiss him. Kiss him on the cheek and so on. And that's what he chose to do. But of course, that gesture should have been a gesture of affection and love. But it was a pretense, wasn't it? It was a sham. He comes up to Jesus, perhaps in the idea that he'd be able then to walk straight up to Jesus without arousing any suspicion from him, presumably in his thoughts process, and just be able to walk up to Jesus, kiss him on the cheek, and then the men would grab Jesus and chain him up and all the rest of it. Matthew and Mark tell us in their Gospels that he greets him, "Rabbi." Again, it's a sham, isn't it? It's a mark of respect, but it's the opposite. This is a humiliating thing to happen, isn't it? To be betrayed. To have someone who's meant to be your friend, and with this action that's meant to symbolise friendship and affection and a word of respect like rabbi and so on, he walks straight up to Jesus. And there's Jesus, betrayed with a kiss. Some of the disciples are outraged, shocked by what they see happening. Seems to all the preparation, all the things Jesus has been telling them, has gone over their heads. And just to suddenly see this armed mob there in the garden as Jesus is finishing his prayer time and Judas leading them, and some of the disciples jump to Jesus' defense. They're out with their swords. They ask, verse 49, shall we strike with the sword? It doesn't seem they get an answer. So that they do, and they whip out the swords. They mentioned they had two back in verse 38, just before, and they've got their swords. And the other Gospels tell us Peter was one of those. In a brave act of loyalty, but not understanding what Jesus had said, it was a rather misguided attempt, wasn't it, to stave off what was happening there in the garden, to prevent his arrest and so on. Perhaps they were hoping. Out one whips with a sword, probably goes for this man's head, and the man ducks and loses an ear. And then Jesus calms it all down. More of that in a minute. And then in verse 52, watching the whole thing, there's Judas and this armed mob. And they're standing a little further back, perhaps, we're told in verse 52, are these chief priests and the captains of the temple and the elders who'd come out to him. They're leading this party. Now they're watching what's going to happen. They're not going to dirty their hands themselves. They've got guards and a mob for that purpose. But these chief priests and the scribes are all watching what's happening. These elites from the city of Jerusalem. And perhaps they're smugly standing there with their arms folded, watching these things in front of them, gloating, congratulating themselves. And then finally in verse 54, they're going to lead him off to the high priest's house. They've done it. They've hoped for this moment for ages, been planning it for months, how they could possibly achieve this. And then finally, as it were, all the pieces came together when Judas volunteered his services, and they've done it. They've got Jesus in their grasp. And it's one of those passages in the Bible that is so humiliating, isn't it? It's heartbreaking. I don't know if you've ever experienced a betrayal of a friend. Someone turned their back against you. When people describe it, don't they? When the bottom falls out, your heart sort of drops down into your boots, as it were. And you just think, oh, everything's just come crashing down. Here's Jesus, and he looks utterly defeated. What is Jesus going to do with 11 friends, a couple of them fishermen, a couple armed with swords? But what do they know? How are they going to possibly defend Jesus from this mob? And he's captured. He's under their power. And it is true what he says to them in verse 53. This is your hour and the power of darkness. This is your hour. This is it. It is your time to do those things you set out to do. This is your time for this. And it's the power of darkness. It's hard to tell exactly in the translation. Some have it, the hour of darkness. This is a time when it seems utterly dark. It seems that sin has the upper hand. The evil of Judas and the mob and the chief priests and the rest of it seems their evil reigns. It is so utterly dark there in the garden. And it may be, in this other way of translating, it's the hour and the power of darkness, perhaps referring to that satanic influence. It's the power of darkness that's at work now. The prince of darkness, the powers of evil are at work. This was a human thing happening in the garden. We said Judas and the mob and the chief priests and so on, but there was also something satanic happening. This was the devil's plan to get rid of Jesus, to have him eliminated, to have him wiped out. That's the power of darkness. That's Satan's work going on here. In all that darkness, we see a glimmer of light. And in all this humiliation for Jesus, we see his sovereignty too. Sovereignty too. Although everything seems utterly bleak, actually, well, you could look through the same thing we just read and see that Jesus actually is still sovereignly in control of all of it. Jesus takes the initiative off Judas. As Judas makes his way forward, he's about to kiss Jesus, and Jesus says, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" This isn't a surprise. It isn't that Jesus is completely dumbfounded when a friend walks up to him and kisses him on the cheek and Jesus suddenly thinks, "What on earth happened?" It's not that at all. Jesus has spoken about it before. He's identified his betrayer at that last meal. He knows, and he sent Judas out in John's gospel to go and do what he's going to do. In some of the other gospel writers, as Jesus finishes praying, he says, "Arise, let's go and meet my betrayer." To meet your betrayer rather takes the sting out of it, doesn't it? In the sense of, yes, this is still betrayal. Yes, this would have felt horrible for Jesus to have a friend do this. But Jesus is the one seizing the initiative. He goes to meet Judas. He says to Judas, almost at the last moment, "Are you really doing this? Is this it? Is this what you're going to do now? Betray me with a kiss?" As well, his language he uses, "Are you betraying the Son of Man?" And again, that reminds us of something he said. It might be on your opposite page. Verse 22, at the end of the Last Supper. And Jesus says, "And truly the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he's betrayed." It's almost the same language, isn't it, he uses then. "Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" Jesus says to Judas, "Remember, woe to the one who does that. But the Son of Man will go as it is determined." He will do it. It looks utterly humiliating, but Jesus is in sovereign control. We see the same in this failed attempt of the disciples to protect Jesus, whipping out their swords. But Jesus is the one who stops the violence. Jesus stops the violence. And he says no more of this in one of the other versions. No, stop this. This isn't how it's going to go down. With a bloodbath, with a fight. No. I've come to meet my betrayer. I'm going to go with this gang into Jerusalem. Jesus puts a stop to the violence. And then he says these strange words, verse 51. Jesus answered and said, "Permit even this." It's hard to tell exactly what he's referring to. He might be meaning, "Permit even this." He might be saying to his disciples, "Permit this to happen. I am going to be arrested. I am going with them now into Jerusalem. Permit even this." Or he could be referring to his healing he's just about to do. And there's this mob all around him, people rushing here and there, a couple of swords out. Goodness me, it seems a bit out of control. And Jesus says, "Stop a minute. Permit me to do this." And it is a remarkable thing, isn't it? In this situation that it seems on the cusp of descending into a bloodbath, of who knows who could get killed in this, and this arrest process, it's all paused. While Jesus reattaches the ear of one of his enemies. That's a weird moment, isn't it? They're in the garden, you've got the disciples, you've got all these flickering torches, we've got a mob armed with swords and clubs. And you've got one man who's got injured. And Jesus says, "Hold on a minute, stop." Does he have to bend down and pick up the ear? Don't know if you'll feel a bit squeamish at that. And Jesus has to reattach this man's ear while everyone in the mob is watching him heal one of his enemies, a servant of the high priest who's come here to do his master's bidding and so on. Everyone patiently waits while Jesus heals the man's ear, and then they carry on with the arrest. It's bizarre. On one level, isn't it? What goes through their heads as they watch Jesus heal someone and they're then going to arrest for all the supposed evil things they think he's up to and the rest, because they think he's in the wrong side. And this is his last healing. What did that man think? That servant of the high priest. In some of the other gospels, he's named, isn't he? Who knows the significance of that? He's the last person Jesus ever healed. And he's the one who Jesus pauses everything for. And then again, in verse 53, you say just 52 and 53, just before the arrest happens, Jesus questions the leaders. In a little while's time, they're going to have all their questions for him. But Jesus starts with a question for them. Have you come out as if you're coming against a robber? With swords and clubs? He says, who do you think I am? Who are you arresting here in the garden? Some armed robber? Or are you arresting a healer, which they just witnessed? A teacher? That's where he sort of carries on, verse 53. I was with you every day in the temple. Luke's told us that. Every day this week, Jesus had been there in the temple. Well, why did he not seize me then? Jesus is putting the question back to them. Well, why are you doing this now? I was in the temple every day. But of course, we know, going back through some of the things that happened in the chapter before, that they were afraid of the crowd. And back in chapter 21, they couldn't openly confront him about anything. And so Jesus is saying, so what is it? What is it you're arresting me for? If you had any legal reasons, you could have done that before. If you had any arguments with what I've been teaching, you could have done that. But you didn't. Because this is your hour. The power of darkness. Jesus is sovereignly in control of this bleak scene, isn't he? Well, we better head on. Luke skips ahead, actually, through some of the early bits of trial with the high priest and so on. He's going to give us a summary, which we'll get to probably next week, in verse 66 onwards. But Luke carries on the story then straight away with Peter. And we see, secondly, then, Peter's failure. He wants to see what happens to Jesus. He doesn't want to abandon Jesus. And so Peter follows after them, this band that they head back into Jerusalem. And then Peter goes into the courtyard of the high priest, we're told. He wanders right into the enemy camp, doesn't he? To be there, to see what happens. There he is, surrounded by the high priest's staff and servants and so on. Peter has put himself in a very dangerous place. And he's very ill prepared for what's going to happen. And Luke rattles off the questions quite quickly, although he does point out that they happen with a little time interval in between them. First up, it's a servant girl in verse 56 who recognises Peter's face there by the firelight. And she's the one who asks, or says, as a statement, this man, Peter, he was with Jesus, definitely. Caught off guard. Not by some burly soldier, but by a servant girl. And Peter panics and lies and says, no, I don't know him. Nothing. No, I know nothing about him. Luke tells us, verse 57, he denied him. Peter denied Jesus. There has happened at once. On then to verse 58, a little while later, someone else said to Peter, you also are of them. You're in their group, weren't you? And quickly, Peter stammers out, man, no, I'm not. And then an hour later, Luke tells us, verse 59, and another confidently affirmed, says it very authoritatively, surely this fellow also was with him, for he's a Galilean. Others refer to that. They noticed his voice, that his accent showed that he was from Galilee. And Peter gets more aggressive. Man, I do not know what you're saying. Again, some of the other gospel writers have Peter sort of calling down oaths at this point, swearing that he's telling the truth and doesn't know anything about Jesus at all. And then what does Peter see and hear? in the instant afterwards. We're talking in verse 60. Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed, the cockerel crowed, and he saw Jesus' face. Maybe Jesus was being moved from one location to another around the high priest's courtyard. Anyway, at that moment, Peter and Jesus lock eyes. And it all comes and dawns on Peter what's happened. And I'm thinking he denied Jesus once, but he didn't even notice, really. And does it again. He's just trying to survive. He's just trying to avoid getting in too much trouble. He's not really thinking about it, perhaps, what's happening. And then it dawns on him. Peter remembered what Jesus had said all along. He made great boasts, didn't he? Great proud ideas that he would die for Jesus. Here it is, a miserable failure. It really is. He's questioned by a few servants. And his bravado comes crashing down. And what does Peter do? He leaves weeping bitterly. End of verse 62. He denied ever even meeting Jesus, that Jesus meant anything to him at all. 3 times he denied anything to do with Jesus. So you see, secondly, Peter's failure, but there's hope too. In what he says, or what's recorded in these words, he had seen Jesus' face. What he saw, we could only guess. Was it a look of disappointment or of grief? Or was it a look of love and compassion? But we're told in verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me 3 times. Peter remembered Jesus' word. And what had Jesus said? We're given a little bit of it there in those verses. "Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me 3 times. That happens, of course, back in verse 34. That's where Jesus said those words originally, predicting Peter's denial. And what is it that Jesus had predicted? He predicted that failure, yes, but he'd also predicted restoration. The quote comes from verse 34, but there's a bit more in verse 32, where Jesus says, "I've prayed for you, Peter, that your faith should not fail. And when you've returned to me, strengthen your brethren." So as Peter weeps bitterly, and Peter has the realization of his humiliating failure, there is also a bit of hope. For we're told Peter remembers the word of the Lord. And that's a very strong statement. That's the kind of thing that's used in the Old Testament all the time about the word of the Lord who came. And here is the same phrase. He remembers that the cast iron solid word of Jesus, a word that predicted his failure, yes, but a word that encouraged restoration too. And maybe even in this darkest hour of Peter's, maybe there still was a glimmer of light. As Jesus looks on him, and Peter remembers, as a maybe somewhere deep down in Peter's breaking heart, he remembered those words of Jesus, "You can return to me, and I've prayed for you." There was hope. There was hope for Peter, and sometimes that's good to remember. There's hope for us. Maybe in our failure, in our heartbreak, when we've made a right hash of things and everything seems utterly dark, to remember the word of the Lord. And that brings hope. Hope in our failure. Hope when we've got nothing at all, not a leg to stand on. But hope in the restoration and compassion of the Lord Jesus. Lastly, last couple of verses, just 63 to 65 then. To finish off, we see lastly then the enemy's cruelty. Luke tells us more than the others actually of the soldiers and their treatment of Jesus. This probably happens in between some of the trials. A bit more of told about Jesus' trial in verse 66 onwards, which we'll look at another time. But probably in between some of those, he's given over to the soldiers. They're just guarding him in between. And they take the opportunity to have their own fun with Jesus. And they mock and beat him, we're told, in verse 63. And they blindfold him. And they strike him in the face. Here is Jesus and he's powerless. Maybe he's literally chained up, chained hand and foot. He can't even protect his own face as they punch him or hit him with their staffs or whatever it might be. Here it is, a bleak chapter, isn't it? Dark chapter. We see the darkness of human nature, a cruel, sadistic pleasure at hurting someone who can't defend themselves. Here is Jesus and he can't fight back. And so they smash him in the face. They beat him to a pulp because they can, because they've got all the power. And they can do what they like to this defenseless person. They have words too. And they spoke blasphemously against him, verse 65. And there's a twisted pleasure in it, isn't there? They seem to get their kicks out of this. Their taunts, their ridicules. They've heard of Jesus being a prophet. So they come up with this game. They'll blindfold Jesus. And there's the gang of soldiers standing round him. And one of them will punch him in the face. And they'll say, "Go on then, prophet. Tell us who did it. Point out which one. You prophesy now." For them, it's a cruel joke. It's bad, isn't it? It's horrible to see this kind of behaviour. Yeah, the unbridled cruelty, vengeance, hatred. It's horrible, isn't it, to see? But at the same time as seeing the enemy's cruelty, there is also fulfilment. Their joke is true. Funny, odd way, isn't it? They're doing it out of this horrible, sadistic pleasure, a perverse sort of enjoyment of this. Prophesy, who's the one who struck you? But of course, Jesus had prophesied exactly that. In their ignorance and their horribleness, they're actually saying something that had some truth in it. Do you remember back in chapter 18? On their way into Jerusalem, just on the outskirts of it, Jesus, in verse 31, chapter 18, verse 31, said to his disciples, "Behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and all the things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished. He'll be delivered to the Gentiles and will be mocked and insulted and spit upon. They will scourge him and kill him. And the third day he will rise again." The soldiers laughed and said, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And Jesus had prophesied that exact thing would happen. He spelt it out before. This is what's going to happen. I'll be delivered to the Gentiles, soldiers and so on. They'll mock him, insult him, spit upon him. Those are the things they're going to do and have done. They'll scourge him and kill him. Jesus had prophesied. He'd spelt it all out. This isn't really Jesus powerless in their midst. But this is Jesus who's voluntarily done all these things. He predicted it before. He could have escaped it if he really wanted to. But he prayed, "Not my will, but yours be done." Now he's seeing it through. There's a determination of Jesus in this. And he had promised, prophesied all this. And even this, down to the details of being hit upon and spat and so on, if that's fulfilled, then won't the rest be? He said, 3 days later he'll rise again. And if everything else has happened to the letter, so must that happen too. And so in this dark, dark chapter, the hour of darkness, can you see still there's a glimmer of light? That light, that radiance, the beauty of Jesus still shine. his sovereignty, his calm control of the situation, his dark, calm determination to see it through to an end, his compassion and kindness to his failing disciples, his fulfillment of everything that had been prophesied beforehand, predicted by the Lord Jesus, planned by his Father. He's seeing it through, right to the end. He is heading to the cross. It is the darkest day. But there's a glimmer of light too. He promised he would rise again, and 3 days later, he would do just that. And in these things, he's working out his purposes. All these evil things, just like Joseph would say, the passage we're looking at with the boys' brigade. Joseph would say, you meant all these things for evil, but God meant them for good. And that's what's happening in this passage. We see men doing evil, but God's doing good. Good's going to come through this. His plan to save sinners like us, to save disciples like us, even when we stumble and fail. And we see the glimmer of light shining out from the Lord Jesus Christ. Beauty, even in the darkness that we see in these chapters. And he's done it for us. As we sang in our hymn, you know, it was our sin. It's his pain that he endured for our sakes.